Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for joining us. Today I'm talking with biochemist Michael Behe, professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, and a senior fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Behe is author of Darwin's Black Box, which was named one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century by National Review and World Magazine, and the follow-up, The Edge of Evolution. Behe has presented his work at major universities throughout North America and the United Kingdom. Michael, welcome back to ID the Future.
Thanks. It's always great to be with you.
Well, on this episode, I'd like to begin a short series, with your permission, exploring the content of your new book, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution, published by Harper One. In particular, I thought we'd focus on part one of your book, which includes the first two chapters.
Sure, I'm always happy to talk about the book.
Awesome. But there's just so much fascinating content in there, and it really helps to have authors break it down a little bit into chunks, you know, that we can easily consume.
Sure.
Well, you spent part of your introduction to the book showing us the history of your own thinking on the matter of evolution and origins. You recount a humorous exchange between you and another postdoc at the National Institutes of Health about what would be required for the origin of life. Can you recall that conversation briefly for us and how it illustrates the power of groupthink, as you said?
Sure, yeah, I remember it well. It was around the year 1980, and I was at the NIH in a lab with a female postdoc named Joanne, and we were both Catholic, and we were talking over the big questions, and we were happy to think that, well, life started by natural processes because perhaps God set up the universe to do that. But she says, well, you know, to form the first cell, you'd need a metabolism. And I said, yeah, and you need proteins too. And she said, some sort of genetic system. And I says, yeah, and membranes too. And we kind of looked at each other and our eyes got big and we said, nah. And then we started to laugh and just turned around and went back to work as if it kind of didn't matter. I guess we figured that even if we didn't know how life might have started, somebody must know. And so, yeah, we were kind of deflected from these heavy questions just because we assumed somebody must know the answer.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that's what was entertaining about it. You know, you just made the assumption. you were happy to accept a natural account, but you didn't know and you figured somebody would. But does that seem to happen a lot, this groupthink where somebody's got to know, but I'll just go with them?
It surely happens a lot in questions about evolution and I guess origin of the universe too. And we generally read popular accounts and they try to make it seem like science, you know, is on top of everything. You know, don't worry, we've got it. And it turns out a lot of that is just kind of wishful thinking.
Well, great little story to start things off. Why did your view of evolution change after you read Michael Denton's seminal book, 1985, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis?
Well, up until then, I thought Darwinian evolution was true. I had no reason to doubt it. That's what I was taught in school. But then in around the mid-1980s, I read Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, and Denton brought up a number of problems for Darwinian evolution, ones that I had never heard discussed before and ones that I myself hadn't thought of. And at that point, I got upset because I said, you know, wait a second, where is all this solid evidence behind the theory? And I came to the conclusion that I was being led to believe in Darwin's theory, not so much because the evidence compelled it, but that's just the way we modern folks are supposed to think. And I got ticked off. I got mad. And from then on, I told myself, well, I'm going to look up myself and see who has explained how these complex biochemical systems that you study every day in biology, how they might have arisen by a Darwinian process. And I was really startled to see that when I looked in the science library, there were no real accounts about any complex biochemical system. There were a few hand-waving type stories, a lot of you know, just giving Darwin after describing an astoundingly complex system. The authors might say, "Well, and isn't it wonderful what evolution has accomplished?" But never showing how that might have happened. And so that's when I became a confirmed Darwin doubter.
Well, that is a crisis, an educational crisis. And although it can be unsettling to us to go through that, I really think it's a great thing to end up going through, because you start to say to yourself, well, I'm not going to take someone's word for this. I'm going to critically think. I'm going to probe. I'm going to go deeper.
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. Unfortunately, I wasn't a student at the time. I was a professor, so I felt a little embarrassed by it all.
Well, in lifelong learning, any time is a good time for that sort of approach.
Yeah, but better late than never.
Sure. Well, this quote caught my attention near the beginning of your book. When one starts to treat Darwinism as a hypothesis about the biochemical level of life rather than an assumption, it takes about 10 minutes to conclude it's radically inadequate. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a lot like that little conversation I had with Joanne, the postdoc, about the origin of life. You start to ask yourself, well, what is needed to get this system going? Well, I need this, and you need that, and you need the other thing, and that over there too. And your eyes get big and say, you know, forget about it. It turns out you need a lot of separate things just to get a system started. And the more things you need, the less and less and less likely that is. So, since biochemistry is just filled with complexity and function, if you know anything about it, then, and you have any reason to doubt Darwin's theory, then the evidence, the structures of the system quickly show you that the theory is very inadequate.
Sure. Well, one of the things I think makes your book very valuable is the reminder you give us that actually now is a really good time to reveal the inadequacies of Darwinian theory. Now, not 100 years ago or 50 years ago even, but now. That's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, you know, since the dawn of civilization, you know, people have wondered how life got here. And most people certainly thought life was designed, life was made. And for the reasons that I talk about too in the books, is that we have a lot of different parts in all different sorts of biochemical systems that are ordered to each other for some purpose, and that's how we detect design. But it turns out that Darwin came up and said, well, maybe if a variation came along and it was helpful, well, then natural selection could select it. It would increase in the population. Then maybe if that happened again, the creature would get better and better and better. But it's only been the past 10 or 20 years that science has developed the easy ability to look at the place where those variations are happening, the mutations are happening. Turns out that mutations are changes in DNA. And since DNA is a molecule, you have to look at life at the molecular level to see what Darwin's theory is capable of. And as I discussed throughout the book, astoundingly, it turns out that those mutations, even the helpful ones, are very largely ones that break or degrade stuff that was already there, break or degrade genes. And, you know, sometimes that helps, but that's not a process that's going to build much of anything.
So you actually start your book with a discussion of epistemology, how we know what we know, or what one Nobel laureate calls the pretense of knowledge. And that's a great place to start, even before you get into all these amazing recent discoveries. Why is it important to start with that?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. It turns out many of these things, you have to have an appreciation for the underlying philosophical issues. And one is, how do we know what we think we know? If you read pretty much anything, any article about evolution in a newspaper or see a show on TV about it, people will tell you, or the TV or article will tell you that we scientists know that Darwin's theory can account for all of life. You know, that's in the bag. We have it covered. But it turns out, if you look at it independently, there is good reason to think that not only don't we know how many things might have come about, there's good reason to think they didn't come about by Darwin's mechanism, and there's also good theoretical reasons to think we can't know, at least for a physical mechanism, we can't know how life came to be the way it is. And I go through a number of considerations in the book just to kind of loosen things up. I give a couple of examples from our, you know, everyday culture about how we are led to believe that we know more than we think we do. And one article that I point to appeared in Scientific American, and a writer was asking about why do they have such self-awareness? And he wrote about it. He said, you know, humans have evolved the greatest self-awareness of any primate species. Or I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember the exact sentence. And I write in the book, I say, well, why don't we change that sentence to this? Humans have a strong sense of self-awareness. And then I ask, you know, the difference between the two sentences is I left out the word evolved. And I say, what difference does that make? And it turns out it doesn't make any difference, because there are no studies showing why humans are self-aware. And it turns out that that word evolved there is just kind of a sciencey way of saying we believe everything is due to Darwin's idea of evolution. But it is what the first chapter is called a pretense of knowledge. And that is, of course, you pretend that you know something, but you really don't. And that is taken from the Nobel Prize lecture of an economist, where he was saying that economists often think or say that they know a whole lot more than they do. And I say that's the same thing with evolutionary biology, that we use language that indicates we know a whole lot more than we do. And that kind of hypnotizes or mesmerizes people into thinking that Darwin's theory is a whole lot better supported than it is.
That was a great connection that you make in the book between economics and evolution. And you also mentioned that since the idea of evolution has few consequences for practical daily life, unlike economics, evolutionary biology gets very little feedback when its theories go awry. And so what does that do to the field?
Well, you know, if you put out an idea like an economist does and said, well, I think we'd be better off if for the next 10 years, you know, we taxed everybody at 10 times the rate we are now. Well, he'd get yelled at and, you know, protests and all sorts of bad things would be directed at him. But if an evolutionary biologist comes and says, well, I think humans evolved self-awareness because of this, that, or the other thing, people in the media especially, you know, pat them on the back and say, look, science shows this, and it's treated, you know, it's treated as something neat, and you get praised for it. So evolutionary biologists, as opposed to economists, don't really suffer any pushback for any of their theories. So they can just kind of speculate to their heart's content. But what I try to show in that first chapter is that economics is actually a simpler subject than evolutionary biology, because economists just try to study how goods and services are traded, how competition works, and so on, but they don't try to explain how the goods that they, whose trading they study, came to be. You know, a microwave oven, cars, and so on. They'll try to explain why they get traded in the manner they do, but they don't study how those things arose. But evolutionary biologists not only promise to tell us why species do better and how they're selected, they promise to explain how the fantastic systems of life actually originated. So they promise to go far beyond economists in their explanation, and pretty smart people have a hard time predicting the next 6 months or so of the economy, let alone billions of years.
Yeah, great comparison. The old saying goes, beware of the sound of one hand clapping. Well, in chapter two, you discuss new tools that make scientific discovery at the molecular level possible. Can you discuss a few of those and what they're revealing?
Sure. Back in the old days, back in, say, Aristotle's time, there were no tools to speak of a biological study. Aristotle used his eyeballs. It turns out we think of him as a philosopher today, but he was also, he's also called the father of biology. And he used his eyes to observe a lot of things about life. But because many things in life are too small to see, he often went, made mistakes. And that was true for scientists for a thousand years after Aristotle, until in the Middle Ages, the microscope was invented. And people were astounded to hear that insects had compound eyes, and that little ticks had a large number of legs, and they had details in them that nobody ever expected. So this opened up a whole new world. And since then, we've realized that the more our techniques advance, the more that our instruments allow us to see into life, the more we know. And so we're almost always dependent on those techniques. Over the years, microscopy has improved a lot. We've gotten electron microscopy and other forms. We've gotten things called NMR and whole lots of techniques in biology, like cloning and like sequencing of DNA, so that we really live in a golden age there. We can even go down and we can sequence the entire DNA set of letters in an organism and pretty much know all of its genetic instructions. Most people have heard about the Human Genome Project, which was completed in the year 2000, more or less. But it turns out that the genomes of a lot of creatures are now known, thousands and thousands. The dog and the cat and the bear and the polar bear and giraffe and all sorts of microorganisms and fish and chickens and so on. So we can compare one to another and really test how mutations happen at the molecular level and what their real effect is.
Wow. So it sounds like the technology that we have today is really helping with scientific discovery at the molecular level, and it's also helping us be able to show the weaknesses in Darwinian theory.
Absolutely. Our knowledge of evolution now, we can start to compare it to, say, the knowledge of our humanity's knowledge of the universe before the invention of the telescope, and then after the invention of the telescope. Well, before, for our understanding of evolution, was about 20 years ago. And after is since the turn of the millennium, where we've had this ability to easily sequence DNA and now get to the very foundation of where evolution is occurring at the molecular level.
Well, and piggybacking on that, how did the discovery of molecular machinery inside the cell, after we were able to see inside the cell, how did those discoveries change the field of evolutionary biology? And can you give us a few examples?
Well, in Darwin's day, the cell was thought to be simple. It was like a little piece of jelly. They called it protoplasm. And it didn't seem like it would be a hard thing to produce. But yes, over the intervening 100 years since Darwin, people discovered proteins and that proteins could catalyze chemical reactions like the breakdown of sugar into energy, and that the genetic instructions were stored in DNA, and that the DNA was carried a genetic code that allowed for the translation of its instructions into protein machinery. And back in the 1960s, people thought there were proteins that catalyzed a few different reactions, but didn't really know much more than that. And as we've learned more and more, we found that there are literally machines in the cell, that the cell is run by sophisticated molecular machines made out of molecules. And the paradigm of this, I think, is a molecular machine I wrote about in my first book called Darwin's Black Box, which is called the bacterial flagellum, which is literally an outboard motor that cells use to swim. And like outboard motors in our everyday world, it's got a lot of mechanical parts that have to be there or else it's broken. And there are little molecular trucks and buses that move down little molecular highways left and turn right because there are little molecular signposts to guide them along. So the cell, we now know, is a whole lot different than what Darwin thought it was. And when you get to such sophistication and complexity, the job of trying to explain how that came about by undirected processes is a whole lot harder than if you're trying to explain a little piece of jelly.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading chapter 2 and you kind of revealing all the machinery of the cell and the amazing things that do need to be explained by any theory that comes along of origins. Well, that's about all the time we have today, but in another episode, I thought we'd look at part 2 of your book, where you survey the theories that have been offered as accounts of the origin and development of life. So I really look forward to that discussion. Mike, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Learn more about Michael Behe's new book at darwindevolves.com. That's darwindevolves.com. And listen to other episodes of ID the Future, wherever podcasts are found, or on the web at idthefuture.com. For the ID the Future podcast, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.